Welcome back to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. I'm your host, Cindy Sheehan. You're listening at CindySheehanSoapbox.com or CPRMetro.org. Our guest today is cartoonist Ted Rall. Ted is a syndicated cartoonist and columnist for Universal Press Syndicate. He's the author of 17 books, a Pulitzer Prize finalist, and twice the winner of the RFK Journalism Award. Rall's cartoons and columns appear in the Los Angeles Times, Mad Magazine, Medium.com, and numerous other online and print publications. His next book is After We Kill You, We Will Welcome You as Honored Guests, Unembedded in Afghanistan. And I had Ted on because he and I, first of all, I admire him, and he's one of my heroes for standing by his principles at all times, but he and I were both banned from that online Democratic right-wing blog called The Daily Kos or Daily Cause or whatever. So stay tuned, and right after this, we'll be back with Ted Rall. Ted Rall, welcome back to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox.
Thanks for having me, Cindy. It's great to be here with you.
Well, like I said before we started, you're one of my heroes because I just really admire people who have principles and whose principles and ideals don't flop around with the winds of, you know, this so-called two-party system we have.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. I feel the same way about you. And you don't have principles if you are. You can have team loyalty, but you can't have
right principles.
Exactly.
One thing that I find so amazing about political cartoons is, first of all, it's just a centuries-old art form and centuries-old way of editorializing. I mean, I can look at a political cartoon from the 1600s and know exactly what that cartoonist was trying to get across to us. And I write opinion pieces, and, you know, for me, it's hard to be brief and concise. I know people don't want to read long, you know, diatribes. People want you to get to the point. But I was looking at one of your cartoons that you did, and in 64 words and 4 frames, you are able to put through a huge opinion. We understand what you're talking about. We get it. And what led you to become a political cartoonist?
Yeah, the simplicity of it is, it's deceptive because, as my mom says, anyone can make something simple complicated, but it takes a lot more work to make something complicated simple. And, when cartoons work, they come together right. That's what they do. Thanks for saying that. Although not everyone can tell. Not everyone is educated about how to read cartoons anymore because they've disappeared from so many newspapers and, the web isn't very good about championing them. But there's, that's a whole different topic. But I got into cartooning when I was a kid. I grew up in Dayton, Ohio. And at the time, the cartoonist at the local paper was a guy named Mike Peters, and he's, in fact, still there. And he was doing a lot of great cartoons about Watergate and Nixon and Vietnam War. And I just remember thinking, like, wow, I was in a city where you either worked at Meade Paper Corporation or you worked for the Wright-Patterson Air Force Base or you worked for National Cash Register. And I was like, it sounds like it would be a lot more fun to make pictures, about the president and making fun of him and getting paid for it. So that's how I got into it. I won a state cartooning contest as a junior high school kid. And, I met Mike Peters and he sort of mentored me. And that's really how I started. My interest in it goes back to comic strips, and I think that, like, sort of the big thing that I've contributed to this field is kind of bringing the comic strip format in, you know, like four panels into the editorial cartoons, which hadn't really been common before I came around. So, you know, I grew up with Peanuts and other comic strips like that, and I always liked the format. And I didn't see why comic strips, why editorial cartoons needed to be a single panel. So always a single panel. There's more you can do. So that's kind of when I finally got, you know, my chance and got syndicated in the early 90s. That's when, you know, I was able to synthesize those things.
Well, I've had I don't know how many local cartoons drawn about me. Some of them are quite nasty. But
I've seen some of them.
Yeah, some of them are amazing. One time when I got arrested at the State of the Union address in 2006, I think, when George Bush was president, somebody made a cartoon of me being let out of the Congress in handcuffs, and the Statue of Liberty was standing there, and she, in horrification, she threw down her book, that, you know, the things that she holds. I thought that was quite an amazing cartoon.
Well, it was a really sad moment, honestly. You know, to me, that and like, you know, you being expelled from the State of the Union and Nader being thrown out of the presidential debates are like two like iconic moments of. You know, the last 14 years, I think. It's just it shows how democracy has really it's pretty much all but gone in the United States.
Well, it certainly wasn't the first time I got arrested, but during the State of the Union speech, when I was shackled to the wall at the Capitol Hill police station, I started crying. I'm like, you know, Jesus, my son supposedly died for, you know, supposedly died for freedom and democracy, and here his mom is shackled to the frickin' wall.
Well, the battle goes on. I mean, you know, it's like, yeah, supposedly is right, but but the fight really does for freedom, democracy, and freedom never ends. And you know, these are dark times. We're living in very bad times. I mean, I never thought things would get as bad under Obama as they have. They're much worse than, I think, from a progressive standpoint, than they were, you know, under Bush. And Bush, God, Bush was bad. You know, it's like, you know, there's always a mistake in thinking that nothing can get worse. Like, everything can get worse. And we're seeing it now.
Well, just in my own case, I was arrested in front of the White House in 2010, and I got a four-month stay-away order from the White House. Like, I had a restraining order against that property, and I got arrested in front of the White House more than a dozen times when Bush was president, and that never happened to me. I never got a restraining order.
I've never heard of such a thing. I mean, you're protesting in front of the White House is that's public property. That's the people's house. People have always protested in front of there.
Right.
Of course, it's, you know, we've seen this process, right? I mean, like, you know, I think it was in the late 1980s when guys with machine guns and anti-aircraft guns appeared with sandbags first on the roof of the White House. And then it was before 9/11, right, where they shut down Pennsylvania Avenue to traffic in front of the White House.
Right.
And then after 9/11, there were guards posted at those four corners out on the street. I mean, they've militarized the White House increasingly to the point where, you know, it's really a bunker now, in a way that it wasn't. And I think, you know, when governments are afraid of their people, and the people realize that the government's afraid of them, it creates this separation that pretty much marks the beginning of the end for a government like that. I mean, like, if you're afraid to walk among the people, if you're afraid that they're going to come in and get you, you know, that's a problem for you. You know, it's a problem for the people. It's also a problem for you.
Well, I always found it extremely striking when I would go to Venezuela, and I even traveled down to Montevideo, Uruguay with President Hugo Chavez, and he would just plunge into the crowd. You know, they didn't have to go through a metal detector. You know, he wasn't in a bulletproof armored vehicle. He would just plunge into the crowd anywhere he went. People would shake his hand, hug him, and in Washington, D.C., the president doesn't leave the White House without cars that have anti-aircraft guns on top of them.
Right. Well, it's
just Chavez a dictator.
Right. No, well, I mean, of course, right? I mean, we live in a bizarro world. It's all topsy-turvy. Everything is exactly the opposite of what they say. I mean, you know, I think what's interesting is, you know, you hear about life during the Soviet period and how people had to read between the lines of Izvestia and Pravda. And now it's like we don't even have to really read between the lines. If you know, we're talking about a clock that always points 180 degrees away from exactly what time it is if you look
exactly.
at the media. I mean, it's insane, really.
Well, this kind of brings us to the reason that I wanted to talk to you today. We have something more in common. Both of us have been banned from the right-wing Democrat-supporting website, Daily Kos. And I was banned in 2007 when I left the Democratic Party and when I ran against Nancy Pelosi. And tell my listeners about your recent experience with the Daily Kos.
Yeah, well...
whatever you want to call it, I don't care.
Yeah, of course. About a year ago, they started running cartoons by lefty cartoonists like Tom Tomorrow and Matt Boras, Ruben Bolling, Jen Sorensen, who are all good cartoonists and friends of mine. This is not about them, but they started paying them, and at the time, I was one of the few left-of-center cartoonists not invited to join. And so I remember complaining about it, and Marcos Melitzos, who owns Daily Kos, said that he didn't want me on there because I'm too hard on Obama. So so I was like, okay. And so but then he did mention that I could blog on there like anyone else. And, you know, I didn't do anything about it for a long time because I'm not really partial to giving my work away for free and
right.
And to contribute to this guy who's making millions of dollars. So instead, but then about 2 months ago, it occurred to me that maybe I should revisit it because if I went and blogged there, I'd be able to drive some traffic back to my own blog. You know, there's a lot of, militant Democrats on that site, mostly militant Democrats, but there's some progressives and leftists and socialists, and I thought, yeah, some of these people might enjoy my work, and they just don't get to see it. They don't know about it because they've been sucked into the hive mind of Daily Kos. So I figured I would just for a few months post my cartoons up there and my columns. All I did was cross-post everything that I normally do for the Los Angeles Times and my other newspapers, and I just cross-posted it. It's nothing new, nothing different. And that doesn't cause any problems anywhere else. About as soon as I came in, there were people who started piling on, who were very angry because I criticized the Democrats and Obama, and from the left, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And they were calling me a right-winger, they were calling me a Rand Paul supporter, a libertarian, all sorts of stuff that just made my head explode.
Uh-huh.
If you know anything about me and my work, that's like, that stuff is absurd. And,
right.
Yeah, they're right-wing Democrats, and they're like, they're issuing death threats against me. I mean, it got really out of control.
God.
But I just kept posting. And then I've had death threats before, you know, comes with the territory, and when you're politically outspoken. And it got uglier and uglier. And finally, after 2 months, I received I went to log on. There was a message from an administrator, anonymous, unsigned, that said, that said, your portrayal of President Obama, the way you draw President Obama, is intolerable. And you have to change the way you draw him because there's a history of drawing black men to appear like apes or monkeys or chimps. And your drawing of Obama is in that tradition. And if you don't change it, you will be blocked. You will be banned. And, you know, I mean, my jaw dropped, right? Because I've been drawing Obama since 2006. And although there was some evolution during the primaries and stuff, I mean, I've drawn him exactly the same way since he became president in 2009. Right. So, and also, if, you know, you're familiar with my work, I draw in a very abstract drawing style. The only difference between Obama and my white characters is just that he's black. You know, right. I mean, it's not like, it's the shading. It's like, you know, I have a, you know, I'm not real interested in caricature. I don't do a lot of exaggeration. I'm more of an idea-based cartoonist. And so, you know, everybody who's familiar with my work didn't see it. And I think you almost have to be racist to see the monkey in the drawing.
I was about to say that. I never looked at that, at how you drew Obama and thought, oh, gosh, you know, he looks like a monkey. But if people look at it and think that, I think that, you know, I was just about to say, that seems racist to me.
It does to me, too. And, I mean, it's also, like, to me, people look like monkeys, if you're going to go that far, because we are monkeys.
Right.
Well, we're apes.
Primates.
I mean,
yep.
We're apes. And, you know, so, like, yeah, I mean, so to me, it was just peculiar. And, you know, obviously, I mean, it's hilarious. Like, oh, really? Like, I was kind of like, well, who the hell do these people think they are to act like a nationally syndicated cartoonist to change his entire drawing style to accommodate an unpaid blog position? Like, really? Seriously? Overnight? You want me to change the way I draw everything? Because to change the way I draw Obama, I'd have to change the way I drew everyone else. You can't have, like, one character in a certain style and have all the other characters not in the same style. So, you know, I'm sorry, I'm not that good of an artist that I can just come up with a new style overnight. And so it was just, yeah, it got uglier from there. So I posted about that, and then there were, you know, then it was off to the races, and there have been probably about 16 or 17 comment diaries that have drawn between 4,000 and 5,000 comments, mostly hostile, not exclusively hostile to me. Marcos Melitzos led the charge personally in one of his diaries, where he, you know, basically endorsed what the administrator had said. You know, that, like, obviously I'm racist. And from that point on, you know, they were out to smear me, these guys. There was a little subset of so-called, they call themselves social justice warriors, who, like, basically, they target sort of left-of-center people who are criticizing Obama. These are Democrats. They're not progressives. And they target, and they try to come up with some way to smear you from a progressive standpoint, to say that you're racist or homophobic or transphobic or you know, misogynist or something that will resonate on the left and they hope that most people won't pay attention. I mean, for example, these same people went after me last week for a cartoon where I used the word fag in the cartoon. And they're like, see, this person, you know, Ted Rawl is a horrible homophobe because he uses these horrible homophobic words. It's like, yeah, but it's a terrible, evil, homophobic character screaming the word fag in the cartoon. And, you know, it's clear that he's an asshole. It's like, you know, so that's like, but they don't say that, right? So it's really unfair. And, you know, they're just sitting there. You know, they conspire. They get together on secret Facebook pages and discussion groups. They figure out who they're going to target. Then they swarm your Twitter feed or your Facebook page or your blog or any place you appear to try to make people think that you're a bad person, a racist in this case. And, it's a phenomenon. You know, I love the word social justice warriors because there's no justice to it. And they're not warriors. They're just sitting on their ass behind a keyboard. Like, I'm sorry, like, you don't know what a warrior is if you think you're a warrior. Like, you know, you're a Mississippi Freedom Rider, you ain't. You know?
Right, exactly. Well, the one thing about this whole episode is, you know, first of all, to me it seems like the DK has lost a lot of its credibility and a lot of its, following along the way. But, you know, Marcos is basically comes from a very conservative Republican background. If I'm not mistaken, he was in the military. He applied to be in the CIA. And so he's just conservative. He's just a conservative. He wrote a book in 08 when I was running against Pelosi. One of the chapters was attacking me. And so, you know, he wrote to me and he wrote to Jody Evans of Code Pink and he showed us the chapter he was writing about me. And we disputed everything that he wrote. He still included it without any of our objections.
So factual objections.
Right.
Was he willing to show it to you? That's so odd.
Yeah, he accused us of things that we really couldn't, there's no factual objections. You know, he accused us of Code Pink pulling my strings. So how do you say, well, Cindy doesn't have any strings and we weren't pulling them. So yeah, it's just, I'm glad that you didn't take this line down because it needs to be, but that thinking needs to be exposed too, because there are two things that you can shut down the left with, calling them racist or calling them anti-Semitic.
Yeah, like if you criticize Israel, the traditional thing is that you're accused of anti-Semitism, which is absurd because, you know, most Israelis criticize the Israeli government. Right, so.
Well, yeah, hello.
Most Israelis are not as far right-wing as their government. Very few of them are.
Right. And, you know, I think the same here, too, when we get down to brass tacks about the United States. But the new icon of the so-called left is now the Pope. And, you know, we can't criticize him anymore either.
Right. No, it's true. Then you're anti-Catholic. Don't you understand, Cindy? Don't you know anything? No, I mean, the thing is, what they're doing is what's really evil about it is that these people are abusing important social justice movements. You know, like racism remains obviously a massive problem in the United States. And homophobia and so on. And these are important movements. And it's, you know, when you start, like, using these terms to smear, you know, sympathetic, progressive, leftist voices, then what you're doing is you're discrediting those same movements. You're probably more effective at smearing those movements than you are at smearing people like you and I. Because most people who know us, we have a track record. You and I, we talk, we write, you know, I draw. Everyone knows who we are and what we're about. And, calling you anti-Semitic or calling me racist isn't probably going to stick. But what it does do is when there are real problems with racism, people hear it and who are on the fence and they think, oh, God, maybe this is just another bullshit, like, politically correct thing.
What really gets me more than being called one of those names is being called conservative or being called a Rand Paul supporter or something like that. I think that shows a lot of ignorance and manipulation on the other side.
Oh, well, yeah, I mean, they're literally willing to say anything. I mean, the thing about Republicans and conservatives and right-wingers is, Lord knows, they love to beat up on us. But, you know, and they bring up crap that's kind of bull, like, you know, calling us anti-American, for example. But at least it fits within some sort of historical political context.
Mm-hmm.
But this stuff is completely just pulled out of thin air, you know, accusing us of being, like, Rand Paul supporters. Really? Like, yeah, I mean, I once wrote a column saying, and I stand by it, saying that it's pathetic and sad that Rand Paul is America's leading, like, mainstream political voice on drones and on the NSA. I mean, that's disgusting. And it's like, my point wasn't Rand Paul is awesome. My point was, where are the Democrats?
Right.
And, you know, but, yeah, it's so intellectually dishonest is what these guys are doing. Like, the DK people, they're scum. You know, I mean, they're not arguing. I think they rank below someone like Bill O'Reilly in terms of intellectual honesty.
Well, the thing is, too, is I love this. I am highly critical of Obamacare or whatever you want to call it from the left. I think that, you know, the only solution is a national health care system, single payer. But I get, Cindy, you sound like a teabagger.
Right, because, well, you know, we're being...
Teabaggers want single-payer health care, right?
Right, exactly. Well, that's what I'm talking about, the intellectual dishonesty. I mean, they don't really believe what they're saying. Or maybe we're talking about people who are so vested in the two-party system that they don't even understand that there's a whole world of politics outside the Dems and the reps. I mean, you know, there's a reason why we have the lowest voter turnout in the industrialized world, which is, and it's not because Americans are apathetic or stupid or lazy. It's because they don't like the two choices that are being offered to them. So, you know, like they, I mean, like in, you know, countries that have vibrant parliamentary democracies with multiple parties from far left to far right have very high voter turnout. And it's like, so, I mean, you can sort of deduce from that that between 40% to 50% of the public isn't voting, but they would vote if they were offered something, you know, that wasn't a Democrat or a Republican. And but yeah, you know, it's kind of like, oh, if you're not for one, you must be for the other. If you don't like the Yankees, you must like the Mets. It's like, maybe I don't like baseball.
Obviously, that must be the truth. And Ted, it's always wonderful to talk to you. I hope our paths cross again one of these days. Are you coming out to California for anything?
I do come to California pretty regularly. I'm going to be there, in February.
Well, let us know, and hopefully we can connect. So give my listeners your website.
Sure. It's, as you would imagine, rall.com, R-A-L-L.com.
Well, great. And Ted, thank you again so much for your consistency. I super appreciate it. It's important to know that we're not out there alone.
Oh, I know. No, there's millions of us. We are strong. It's just we have to get organized.
Absolutely. So, Ted, I hope you have a great holiday season, whatever that means. And,
you too.
And a happy new year. And hopefully we'll talk soon again. Thank
Definitely.
You so much.
Well, that's the soapbox for today. I hope you enjoyed it. And I would like to wish all of you happy holidays, happy Kwanzaa, Merry Christmas, and what we celebrate in our family since my son Casey was killed, Festivus, because we had to create new traditions because the old ones were just so painful without him. And I'd like you to please remember all of the people who are in pain and homeless, cast aside by this system this holiday season for sure. As always, I'd like to thank my engineer and connection with CPR Metro, Don DeBar. I'd like to thank Ted Rall for being my guest and for always being real. And I'd like to thank you for listening and supporting the show. I'm Cindy Sheehan. You've been listening to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. Peace out for now.